We also pursue excellence through JSource and Projegi, the English and French websites we operate in cooperation with the country's leading journalism schools. The country's number one source, I'd like to think, of daily information and ideas about journalism. We also do it through a three-day executive education program for media managers that we run with Rotman, the School of Management, the University of Toronto. We still have a few spots left, and if any of you have a desire to sort of spend a weekend with Rotman experts and some people from the journalism trade, our executive director, Ms. Turvey, is in the room, and she'd be happy to take your information. We also have an annual gala at which we present Lifetime Achievement and Excellence in Journalism Awards. And in addition, we honor Canadians such as Morley Safer and Robin McNeil this year, who have made an extraordinary contribution to contemporary journalism. So our mantra at the CJF is that as journalism goes, so goes democracy. And I hope you'll join us in working for better journalism. Now, in terms of introducing tonight's forum, I know many of you have expressed opinions about bankers and the potential manipulation of journalists. Journalists have been accused of aiding and abetting. We've also heard complaints that financial journalists are captive of the institutions they cover. Those will be among the subjects that we'll be covering tonight. And it's a pleasure to introduce our moderator, Amanda Lang, the senior business reporter for CBC News. And if I may say so as an aside, Amanda, I think you've brought a very timely, expanded, and overdue focus to finance and business on the CBC, which was very welcome. I don't think I need to tell you she is the co-host of CBC business show, The Lang O'Leary Exchange. I don't know if it's kind of some kind of CBC trick, but she's the one who sits from our vantage point on the right, although from the studio perspective, she's on the left, probably where she is most comfortable. Before returning to Canada and to BNN in 2002, where she was the co-host of Squeeze Play, by the way, the Business News Network's nightly information and talk show, Amanda was an anchor and correspondent at CNN and its business network, CNN-FN, in New York, where she reported from the New York Stock Exchange. She was in New York as a correspondent for the Financial Post in 1998 and 1999. She began her career in journalism at the Globe and Mail. And during her years as a business reporter, she has covered stock markets, the economy, financial instruments, the technology beat, Wall Street, Canadian US politics, and more, including reading for the radio news this summer. We had thought about having Kevin O'Leary here tonight, but a committee of CJF had determined that he would be far too politically correct to be in this room, so we whacked him. Thank God, Amanda, you're here. Amanda Lang.
Thank you. Well, I am delighted to be here, and I'm glad to see so many people here. We've got two really great voices on this subject. I have thoughts of my own, which may or may not become apparent. I must say, if there was a right spot for me on the desk, it would probably be right in the middle of it. But you know these two, their full bios are in the program. I'm just going to tell you briefly who they are, just to remind you. But David Moorcroft began his career as a journalist, in fact, but then moved over into the world of banking and spent 30 years at RBC, which many business journalists know has one of the best reputations in terms of kind of branding and reputation. He's won awards for that, in fact, as a communicator. So he spent most of his career as a senior executive in strategic roles dealing with pesky journalists. Elena Cherry is... Cherney is the editor of the Globe and Mail's report on business, as you know. You may also know that she was the Toronto-based correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. She's a multi-award-winning journalist. She's worked at the Montreal Gazette, the National Post. And in her role as an editor, of course, and a former reporter, brings a pretty great spectrum, I think, to what gets covered, how it gets covered, whether it's covered well. I wanted to start just by sort of setting the table a little bit, because we talked a little bit about how intriguing the proposition was. You may remember, it's the state of financial journalism, and it talks about how investors feel blindsided, and Lord knows that's been true. And then the question, are financial journalists captive of the institutions they cover, or is financial illiteracy endemic in mainstream media? There is no positive, as you'll notice, in those propositions. Either we are scapegoats and stooges, or all journalists are idiots, is what's being offered. I think we'll agree that we're going to find some other territory and slightly more positive ground to cover, because I think there actually is a really healthy conversation to be had here, and it isn't just about saying financial journalists screwed up royally. We talked before about how to begin this, and I was offering up this analogy that I've been ruminating on lately, which is that journalism is, to me, about being on the sidelines. It's about not being involved. And I remember as a kid, the first time I realized watching a nature video of a lion eating a gazelle, chasing it, catching it, the carnage that follows, the first time I realized that a human being shot that was standing nearby and just didn't intervene, just had to watch it. And that's what journalists do. We just watch it, or we should, or we're doing something wrong. So I wanted to begin by asking, and I'm going to start with David, from his point of view, having dealt with journalists, understanding the message that he wants to get out or doesn't want to get out and how it gets translated, how you think we're doing?
You know, I go back to the 1980s, 1990s, when most financial journalists had no business background, no financial training, and if you look at some of the stories that were being written in those days, call for, you know, a tax on excess bank profits, a call on a cap for executive compensation, a call for a cap on interest rates, et cetera, et cetera. And I look at the quality of journalism, financial journalism we have today, and I think it's come a long way. It doesn't mean it's perfect and there isn't room for greater improvement, but we have come a long way. I've noticed that when I was dealing with journalists over the years. So there are a number of things that I think are still need to be addressed. I think there were many days, frankly, when I wish we did have journalists who were aiding and abetting and captives, because we had some very rough days and it never happened. So I'm going to put that premise aside to begin with. Believe me, that never happened, as much as some of us would have liked it in the PR business. But we're getting to some of the improvements I think need to take place, but the bottom line is it's come a long way. There are some things today that are impacting it, and we'll get to that, I think, in a few minutes.
And Elena, from your point of view, your career has spanned a spectrum, as has mine, of a real kind of growth in the market, an awareness in the market, and then the collapse. It's the anniversary of the collapse of Lehman Brothers today. An awareness by ordinary people that we need to know about this stuff, whether we want to or not. Do you think we're doing a decent job?
I think the question is what we see. Are we seeing the lion and the gazelle? And I think sometimes the argument could be made that they're well camouflaged. And I don't think that's because we're captives. I don't feel like a captive. But I think sometimes we don't know where to look. And if we don't know where to look and no one is pointing us as journalists toward an institution and suggesting that there might be a problem brewing, we're not always very good at finding the problem before it surfaces. And I think that, you know, you could argue that about a lot of different kinds of journalism. It's not just business journalism, it's political journalism, and that has to do with all kinds of things. The fact that it's very energy intensive and resource intensive to investigate some of these things, and sometimes it's just easier to report what you see. I don't think it's a question of turning a blind eye. It's a question of making sure that we're focusing our attention on the places where the problems are more likely to surface.
I want to note that we really want your questions as well from the room, and so I don't know if there's a way to write them down, but certainly you can stand up and ask them. I will invite you in a few minutes, if you put up a hand, to join the conversation, and obviously we want to make that as conversational and include you as much as possible. One of the things that's happened in the last couple of decades is the 24/7 news model, cable television, and specifically the need to fill a news hole that is entirely about business. And I guess I'm curious to know whether that causes problems, because business journalism was born by a muckraking journalist who went after Standard Oil. There was something to say, something to uncover. She didn't really care that it was a business. Now, we got to talk about business all day long. Does it lower the standards of what we'll be talking about?
I think it's one of several things that does lower the standard. I used to have these discussions with executives at Royal Bank of Canada about Canada being a very small market, particularly for business, and you've got now a 24/7, voracious appetite for business stories. And what happens if there isn't enough to fill the void? Are some stories being manufactured? Are some stories being exaggerated? Are some things not being covered because they're not, sensational enough? They're not going to be entertaining enough. So I think there is a bit of that. It's not the biggest problem. I think some competitive pressures are bigger, but I do think that There isn't as much business news in Canada as there is in the U.S. and the U.K., and I think it is hard to fill that void sometimes, and it does result sometimes in manufactured stories.
Yeah, I also think that kind of coverage, in a sense, plays to the weakness of financial journalism. It plays to the sort of sports coverage version of financial journalism. Markets are up, markets are down, what's driving minute to minute? And that may not be the thing that financial journalists are best at. I think the longer cycle and the more explanatory, deeper dive into the forces behind some of those moves are probably more, I think journalists are better at doing that, and can bring more value, and that may be part of the problem.
Let's go back to this question of investors being blindsided, and the suggestion that, the degree to which, I guess, that financial journalists were culpable in that. We didn't see it, we didn't talk enough about it in 2007, we didn't warn people that it was coming. Is there some accuracy in that?
You know, I think it's a shared responsibility, frankly. I think banks have a responsibility. I think regulators have a responsibility. I think journalists have a responsibility. I think individual investors have a responsibility for not clearly seeing what was happening leading up to 2008 with the subprime mortgage fiasco and what impact it was going to have in the markets. And I don't think you can just blame journalists. I mean, if they were that good at predicting what was going to happen, they'd be at the racetrack picking horses. So I think we have to get away from trying to point the finger and blame one particular profession or group. I think it was a shared responsibility, and we're all equally guilty.
Yeah, I agree with David that it would be a little unfair to expect journalists to have seen the subprime mess before it happened, and particularly the far-reaching consequences that it would have. I think that if you look back at the coverage, major papers, I hope, including The Globe, did a fairly good job of covering what was already a very serious slowdown in the U.S. economy and a housing bubble that was clearly going to bursting and causing some ramifications. But I think that to expect journalists to sort of call the damage that would ensue from the collapse of Lehman, nobody knew what would happen that weekend until it happened, and nobody knew what would fall out from that weekend until after it was already well in motion. So.
One of the things that I've been curious about, there seems, and this may be a Canadian phenomenon, I don't know, I haven't been to many other similarly sized countries to know, but there certainly does seem to be an anti-business bias in this country, not just with journalists, but with people. Anti-corporate, we don't think of our company as something that is part of us, as something separate. And as a business journalist, it's something that I've always struggled with because I think business is wonderful. It creates value and enterprise and jobs. But is that a healthy thing, that distance, or does it create problems? Would you even agree that it's there?
I would agree it's there. I felt that, doing public relations, I always felt from some journalists, some more than others, that there was a bit of hostility, a bit of misunderstanding about what the role of business was. Also, I think there was a deep-rooted suspicion with some journalists that, businesses were always trying to screw someone, were always trying to do something bad, and they didn't have a complete understanding of, the economy and how important job creation is, and it's the businesses that create it. So I think it's gotten better from the 1980s and 90s, but I still felt it up until, I retired doing PR for the bank, that there were some journalists who had an axe to grind and who were a little more hostile to business than others.
Yeah, I've certainly heard that criticism leveled at the ROB. I don't think that I hear that when I talk to reporters. I think I hope that what I hear is an effort to understand how companies make as much money as they do, rather than, any effort to judge why they're doing it, and an effort to explain what the earnings mean. That maybe I'm missing something. I think also if you work with a group of reporters who are specialized business reporters, it may be a different group than a more general kind of group of reporters who sometimes cover business. I don't know.
Let's talk about that, because some of, I see Rod McQueen here. I mean, some of this nation's best business commentators, journalists, didn't go to school to be a business journalist. Is it a healthy thing that we're going that, because now young journalists will say to me, how do I become a business journalist? And I will say, go learn about business, and then see if you can be a journalist. Is that the right approach, or is the specialization actually good for the industry?
Yeah, I think we have both. I mean, I'm, in terms of my education, spectacularly ill-qualified to be a business editor. And we have, in our section, obviously, we have people who have worked. We have somebody excellent and young who has worked on Bay Street. But we have mostly journalists who have learned through the years, through doing and studying companies and talking to executives and understanding the economy and working very, very hard, I think, to become experts in their beat, just the way that you would become a health reporter or a political reporter. And I'm not sure there's anything wrong with doing it that way either. I don't think there is, actually.
Yeah, to me, the dilemma is, do you take people through J school and train them to be reporters? Or do you take specialized people with specialized knowledge, business people, you know, accountants, lawyers, and train them to be reporters? And frankly, I think you need a mix of both. I think J schools are failing us to a great extent because when I used to interview J school graduates, I would say a good many of them were didn't have any financial knowledge whatsoever. In fact, one of them once said to me they went into journalism school because they didn't like math. So maybe they just wanted to do regular, you know, reporting, but if they're in the business stream and they're doing business reporting, it would really have helped maybe if they'd had that kind of training in J school. One of the problems with getting the specialized people into media now is that I'm told that the freelance rates have gone down, so if you're a lawyer or an accountant or financial wizard and you used to write a column or they want you to write a regular column, they're not paying as much as they used to, and that's part of the cost cutting in media. And I think that's creating a problem as well, because those people give you the real insight. They have industry knowledge and background. And even if the reporter has some financial training, they don't have that knowledge of that industry that can really lead to insightful reporting. So I think that's a real dilemma.
But on the other hand, the reporter, the person who's in it simply because they love gathering information and learning and researching and finding things that are not known by the public, may actually be of equal value, especially if we're thinking about why it is that these issues blow up unseen. If you know too much about something, maybe the risk of becoming a captive is greater. Maybe curiosity is actually more valuable or as valuable as subject matter expertise in some cases.
Yeah, I think you need both, because you need the insight that comes from having knowledge of the industry. Then you can be have a little more foresight in seeing some of the things that are coming and separate some of the PR stuff you're being told that may not be that important or may not be that critical. You can tell the difference. But I agree, you need both. I think there's nothing better than a young journalist who has a passion for what they do and wants to learn and do a good job. But I still think you need those seasoned business people interspersed in there as well.
It is an interesting question, this notion of becoming captive to the people you cover, especially when it's a small market, it's a small pool of players. You know you're going to interview the same CEO next quarter unless something happens in the interim to get you chasing after him for something unpleasant. I guess I'm wondering, Elena, with your reporters, how you walk that line. Because you need to have access, you need to have a comfort level to get information, and yet you don't want to go too far.
Yeah, and it's even harder, of course, because it is a small market. So you have, you know, you're talking to somebody and you want to talk to an executive, you want to talk to somebody who's on the board of directors, and there are so many linkages in corporate Canada that, you know, that itself becomes even more challenging. I think in terms of the reporters, it's a very fine line. And it's a case-by-case situation, and people have to make their own judgments and have to decide what they're comfortable with. You can't burn people, but you have to be prepared to push back and not to tell the story the way your source necessarily wants you to tell the story, David. If it's not a fair way to tell the story.
You know, I think it's critical for beat journalists, you know, journalists who are covering, financial journalists who are covering an industry, to be able to spend time with and get to know the senior people in the various companies. I don't think that's a bad thing. That's a good thing. That gives them insight. However, there's a fine line between being able to have access to people and being able to speak to them when you're working on a story and kind of falling in love with them, because, big CEOs have personas, and in many ways, some of them become celebrities. And I've seen some journalists actually be in awe of that kind of celebrity status. So I think that's what you have to watch out for. You need access. You need to be on a personal relationship where you can call and get information, but you can never be in awe of that person.
But I would also flip it back to you a little bit in terms of the CEOs and the leaders, the business leaders in this country. And having worked for an American paper, I think there's a big difference between what Canadian business leaders are willing to say and what American business leaders are willing to say. Sometimes I think that, frankly, Canadian business leaders are much more reticent to go on the record to say things that are not even bold, but to actually speak to issues for fear of, I'm not quite sure what, then American leaders. And I think sometimes that can breed that kind of coziness between the reporters and the CEOs, because the executive will speak to you off the record. You'll use that. It's always better to have the person on the record. And I think we would also, to the whole point of transparency and doing our jobs well, we would do a better job of getting the story across and getting investors the information that they need and the public the information they need if companies were more cooperative in terms of providing comment.
I agree with you. Let me tell you what I think the problem is, because I heard this from CEOs all the time. I don't want to talk to the reporter because I'll be taken out of context. I'll be quoted out of context. And, you know, the news distillation process is one where you take a bunch of information and put it into, you know, a 900-word story or a 1,200-word story. But I used to say to executives, if you don't provide too much context, you can't be taken out of context. So I think it's, you know, the CEOs haven't got their message straight, so they ramble. And then the reporter takes that rambling and tries to make it into a coherent article. They end up, you know, taking the executive out of context. You know, it's a shared responsibility, but that's why they've told me that they don't like to do too many interviews. They're afraid of being taken out of context.
Well, I don't know about you, Amanda. I would take some issue with the idea that people are regularly taking executives out of context, and that is something, you know, I think that goes to the relationship. That's where the relationship of trust is important. If an executive knows that a reporter is really dedicated to understanding what it is that they're doing, whether it's business journalism or really any kind of journalism, then they may have a greater willingness to speak to the reporter, because they know that this is not somebody with an axe to grind. This is somebody who wants to understand and write a clear, fair story.
It gets to this issue of how journalism may evolve, because we live in a world where, of course, we don't really need to be distilling things. If somebody's interested in what happened at RBC's annual meeting, they can catch the whole thing online. Journalism is still interpretive to some degree, and I guess I'm wondering whether for specialists like sports or arts or business journalists, interpretation isn't part of the job. It isn't what we're supposed to be doing, and we kind of dance this line then of opinion.
Well, I think in some ways, the more raw data becomes available and the more sources of information there are, the more important the interpretation is, and the more that's our value, and that's essentially our brand. And what we're selling, or what we're trying to put out there, is our ability to offer the best analysis and the best interpretation, and that means the most accurate. So, I mean, people can vote with their feet, and the market can vote with its, you know, where people choose to go. And I think that, yeah, we should be held to a standard of accuracy and fairness, but to not provide interpretation, I think, would be to fail as more and more information becomes available.
You know, I agree that interpretation is part of the responsibility of the journalist. There has to be a clear delineation in the media so that the readers or the viewers know what's interpretation and what's just reporting on the facts. That's why I think business executives prefer to deal with someone that they, A, have a relationship with, and B, they know, understands the industry, and understands, you know, has some financial acumen behind them, because they have a greater sense that what they're saying will be interpreted correctly.
I guess I remember this morning in my kitchen, the two national newspapers both reporting on the results of the Zamboni trials on MS. Maybe this might have been last spring. And they had opposite headlines. One thought it was a great success, and the other one thought it was a great failure, and they used the exact same stats. And I kept them as an example of how you can use numbers, and three quarters can seem like a lot or it can seem like a little, depending on how you want to interpret it. In business journalism, there may be less room to maneuver between things, but the more complex the issues get, the more room there is for gray area.
That's one of the things I've always liked about business journalism, as opposed to other kinds of journalism, is that the numbers and the facts are there, and you can't get too far away from them. The question is really just how intelligent your interpretation is and how intelligent your analysis is. And again, I think that where we tend to sort of fall short, or more likely to fall short, is in the kind of minute-to-minute spot analysis, market analysis. It's those longer cycles and trends and the stories that carry that I think, where I think we can add the most value.
You know, I think a couple of challenges, and one is, We've heard this before, the herd mentality, or, you know, the bandwagon approach to reporting, where, you know, someone does a story and then the rest of the group of reporters all jump on the bandwagon and start running with the same thing. You know, Canadian banks were too conservative up until the financial crisis. Royal Bank of Scotland was held up as a great example of what Canadian banks should be like. Acquire all over the world, grow rapidly. You know, one reporter, two reporters, two media outlets start with this, and then everyone else is on the bandwagon. No one's questioning it. The same thing happened with Nortel. Nortel was the darling of the media. No one really took a hard look at their financial situation and looked at, after all those acquisitions, the premiums they were paying, they weren't really making any money. I remember sitting in a room with a reporter, and Peter Curry was actually telling a reporter this, and it was like, it kind of glazed over the person's eyes, because the, you know, the accepted theory was that Nortel was a great company. In fact, the reporter gave Peter a hard time about leaving Nortel and going to Royal Bank of Canada. He thought it was a dumb move. So it's not, there are great reporters and there are people who don't jump on the bandwagon, but it is one of the problems that I've seen in business reporting.
Well, I think that those are great examples. The journalists are not the only ones, though. There's an entire research community out there. There's an entire industry, and people who are paid, as one of my colleagues noted the other day, probably 100 times more in some cases than the average reporter, experienced financial reporter in this city, make greater mistakes that cause investors to directly lose far more money. I mean, you look at Sinoforest, for example, and the 7 buy recommendations before that short sellers report came out in early June. That's a great example of how, you know, the reporters are not the only ones who are failing to see the issue.
Well, in some cases, it's the reporter following the advice of the analyst. But I guess my point was that maybe they need to challenge that analyst's point of view, or maybe they need to verify with others, and maybe they need to talk to some of the business experts on their own, or they need to just have, you know, more of a questioning view, because there are a number of examples like that. And I realize that it doesn't always start with the journalist, but maybe they're not questioning their sources thoroughly.
How are those analysts coming up with their views? I think what the journalist can really provide to the public, you know, the analysts work for banks. We all know what some of the issues have been involving analysts working for banks and the relationship with investment banking fees. In some ways, what I think reporters can bring to the table is the promise that they're not working for anybody except the reader and or the user, depending on. They're distilling all of this information that's out there, and yeah, they're going to miss things, but at least you can know that what you're reading is not compromised, frankly.
I guess I would flip it back to you, David, just as a representative of corporations, not you know, people hate the banks because your service fees are too high. Do something about that, and you know, all the anti-bank stuff will go away. In fact, the last time I had lunch with a bank CFO, he put $1.50 on the table and said, "There's your service fee, okay? The ATM charges drive me nuts." But corporations do lie; they do. They obfuscate even bank earnings. The degree to which they are adjusted one to the other is quite extraordinary. That's kind of boring, and maybe not everybody's that interested in reporting it. But part of the dynamic is that we are aware that we don't get all of the information. We need to work with each other, and we rely on you to give it to us. But there is a kind of a through line that we're not getting the truth all the time from all corporations.
Okay, so I have to take exception with the fact that you said business executives lie, CEOs lie. I think, you know, they'd be in jail, and the ones that did lie are in jail. I mean, we have a very tough regulatory system now on financial reporting, on compliance. There's the whistleblower program. So if things are going wrong inside, people can report it. So I've never known any CEO or business leader to intentionally lie. Is there, you know, do people see things differently? Are there different ways of accounting for things? Absolutely. It's all, you know, legitimate way of accounting. It's all legitimate way of seeing things. We all see things differently. Are they giving enough information all the time? No, there's a reluctance to provide too much information. There's a reluctance, you know, they all hide behind safe harbor because there's a reluctance to provide information that may cause people to buy or sell stock that may in the end not be truthful or may not end that way. So they have to be very careful so they don't become culpable for these things.
Yeah, I'm not sure about lying. I think it's pretty rare that you actually are able to catch somebody lying outright. When it happens, it's a great story. Obfuscation, I think, happens a lot more. And I do think that there's a role for the media there. And I do think that reporters should be able to ferret out in many, many instances when they're not, when things aren't quite adding up. I mean, little simple things like, I mean, my favorite one is the weather, is when companies, you know, blame the weather. I know, I'm sure this is actually very valid. This doesn't really have to do with banks, but in some sectors, in retail, you know, that you see sort of explanations for one-time items.
Careful, because there's actually litigation on the books, Danier Leather, and they won that lawsuit. You
the
can't,
weather one?
They,
you're
you,
allowed to
you can blame the weather.
If it's legitimate.
If it's legitimate, of course, yes.
But I think that the reporter has to point out, for example, has to actually dig in deep enough to explain that, yes, there were all these one-time items, but at the end of the day, net, this is how the company's performing. And I think that's where there can be value brought to bear by the journalist.
Yeah, and I should clarify, when I used the word corporations carefully when I said corporations lie, and I'm in the Mitt Romney camp that corporations are people. But when I say that, I mean I don't mean a CEO gets up and lies often. Obfuscation is what happens there. What I mean is there is a corporate messaging, there's a strategy, that may add up to inaccuracy. I don't think it's ever one decision of somebody saying, I know the answer is X, but I'm going to say Y. But it's a whole series of decisions that they would all prefer that Y to be true, and it winds up being the cast that's given it.
Maybe it's a question of also just timely disclosure and the degree to which, I mean, Nortel may be a great example. There are other more recent ones that I don't know if I can say out loud, but you know, how much information is the public being given at what time?
Yeah.
And even if, as the journalist, you're not in a position to say, you know what, that smells bad and it just doesn't add up and there's a problem with these numbers, you can probably ask the question in some other way. And sometimes, you know, it doesn't make for the best reading because you have to sort of write it in a slightly kind of on the one hand, on the other hand way. But I think there are ways to raise questions when something doesn't feel like it's adding up.
So let me, while we're on the topic of what could be better in journalism, if you know, we want to talk about different areas. One thing that's always bothered me is what I call theory journalism. And that's when a reporter, usually aided and abetted by someone who wants to remain anonymous, who has a theory about something that's wrong with a company or something that's wrong with an industry or something that's wrong with an individual, goes to that reporter, kind of sells them on doing the story. The reporter goes to their editor, sells the editor on giving them the time to do the story. They investigate a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, maybe a month investigating the story. Then they finally call the company or the industry or the person who's the object of the story, and we're going to run with this story in 2 days, 3 days, and, you know, disprove all the research I've done and all the time I've invested in putting the story together. I can tell you that, having been on the other side of that, it doesn't usually turn out well, and sometimes it shouldn't, but there have been occasions when you actually provide the proof, and it doesn't matter because too much time has been invested in putting that together. And I can give you examples, but it happens. And I just wanted to ask you, you know, what you thought about
that. I'd like examples.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I'm kind of wondering which one you're.
Well, I'm going to use one. It was, I don't know if you remember Andrew Rankin. Andrew Rankin was a rogue investment banker at RBC. He was either unintentionally or intentionally telling his friend about some of the accounts he was working on. These were going to be deals, you know, mergers, sales, acquisitions. And then that was found out. He went to trial. And so at one point, someone decided that there was more trading, advanced trading, in deals that were being confidentially considered at RBC than in the U.S., what the average was in the U.S. So they did lots of research to prove that was the case, came to us, so we did the research and said, you know, that's a very, very good concept, but you've got it slightly wrong. If you look at all the big banks that are doing deals, there is the same amount of advanced trading in a certain number of accounts, and it's greater than the U.S., but it's across the board in Canada. And basically, Canada is a leakier environment than the U.S. for deals because it's a smaller community. Fewer lawyers, fewer accountants, word gets around. And as a result, there tended to be more advanced trading before some of these deals were done. But it was no different at RBC than it was at all the other banks. But it was a good story if you compared the U.S. market to the Canadian market as to why Canada was leakier. But we couldn't convince this reporter to not focus on RBC and Andrew Rankin. They didn't want to do the big story. They wanted to just bring it to what they had researched and had wanted to do from the beginning, which I thought sold the investment the readers and investors short.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if you go back to the company that you're writing about, and they have an alternative version of what happened, you know, you need to reconsider your theory. I don't remember this particular story. I don't know if this is a Globe story or this may predate me.
Do you really want me to tell you?
No, evidently not. never ask a question to which you don't know the answer. I think, though, that your comment about leakier deals made me want to go back to the regulatory point and the question about the regulatory environment in Canada and whether, in fact, I mean, I think sometimes in this environment, because, frankly, there is not a track record of aggressive, assertive regulatory action and enforcement, I think sometimes it's possible that journalists, you know, see a role and an opening there and seek to compare Canadian corporate performance against U.S. performance in the absence of tougher regulation. And I wonder if that's what's happening there.
That's what the story should have been. That was my point. That's what the story should have been. They should have been comparing the U.S. and Canadian markets, not just picking out one company, because the statistics showed that all the big banks doing the deals were in the same situation. It's just a leakier marketplace. Fantastic story, never written that way.
To be fair, it was accurate to say RBC is leakier than comparable U.S. banks.
Yes.
Accurate statement. The context was lost.
The context was the Canadian market is equally leaky, so it unfairly singled out RBC.
Yeah, so the question is, was the reader served by that story?
In my view, no.
I would hope not.
Was there a reaction?
For RBC.
Was there a, what was the reaction to the story? What did the stock price, did it affect RBC stock price?
You know, I think the stock price had already been impacted by that whole situation, so I don't think, in fairness, I don't think it had any impact, but it did hurt the brand, you know, and brand is something that companies spend a lot of money and effort to build.
And what was your response to it? How did you manage that with whatever publication this might have been?
I went to the editor of the section, and we had a talk about it, and frankly, they agreed with me. So the story never ran again.
Well, we don't usually run them twice. You've won the good.
It was no follow-on.
They took it out of all the bird cages. Yep. I want to just remind you that if you have a question, the mic is here, and you should just come down and stand in front of it, and then I know you have a question. So feel free. When I see you, I will go straight to you. There's another recent example of that, though, and I don't know whether this is a David question or an Elena question, of literally a story that was not just denied but disproved by the subject, and I'm forgetting what it was at the moment, but it later had to be retracted somewhat embarrassingly. That kind of 11th hour, why do journalists wait so long? We kind of wait till the last minute.
Wait so long to what?
To go to the company and say, we have this body of evidence against you, you have 10 minutes to give me your reply, and then we're going to press with it.
Yeah, there's a lot that goes into that timing question. There are a lot of people in this room that I've probably had those conversations with. It depends. When I worked at the Wall Street Journal, there was a philosophy of reaching out and ensuring and taking every possible step to make sure that whoever it is has the opportunity, particularly if it's sensitive. Obviously, we're talking about sensitive issues, not run-of-the-mill stories. And I think that that's a very, very good approach. And the problem with that approach, obviously, is competitive. So if you give a company 48 hours to respond to a sensational story, there are a number of things that can happen, and some of those things have probably happened to some of the people in this room and spoiled some great scoops. Yeah. So, you know, it's a balancing game.
Question from the room?
Oh, hi. My name's April Lindgren from the Ryerson School of Journalism. I was actually really interested in this example about Canada being leakier, and it just made me think about all the poor mugs that sort of go out and invest in their RRSP in a stock market. And I think a lot of people think the market is fairer than it maybe is, and they're not aware that, you know, there's leakiness, more so even here than in the States. And I'm just wondering if you guys could comment a little bit on whether you think the business pages almost promote the idea that in fact it's a fair and even playing field for everybody, when in many ways often it isn't.
You know, it's funny because as you said that, what strikes me is almost by implication, yeah, I guess you're right. I mean, by writing about markets the way we do and covering them like sports stories, you know, up, down, sideways, who won, who lost, we're lending a whole lot of credibility to the activity itself. I think the finer point is how critical, how much of a critical eye can we bring to bear, finding obfuscation, finding targets to investigate that need to be investigating, always being fair and giving people lots of time to respond, and then, of course, changing things if there's something unfair about it. But, you know, yeah, I guess that we don't every day run a disclaimer that says, this market may not be regulated as well as it should be. We just sort of try to go out and find the problems, you know, the failures of regulation when they happen.
Having said that, I think there's a great effort, a better effort today than ever, so far in our history, to cover this stuff. You know, the fact that it's mainstream now to talk about business and markets and investing, financial literacy is hugely important, it's recognized by everybody as a major issue. It gets us a little bit further down the road. Most people find it dead boring, so it's hard to get it, to sort of persuade people to even read stories about, you know, why you should never buy a mutual fund. But
you know, to the media's credit, I've read a number of articles where they're critical of regulators, you know, the enforcement side, and judges who don't give tougher penalties in Canada for white collar crime. It's tougher in the U.S. We have a problem here in Canada being tough on these things, and it really bugs people in business who are straightforward and honest and don't like to see that kind of thing. But if you really want to see the Wild West when it comes to investing, try penny stocks. I mean, that's really wild. There's nothing honest about that going on anywhere.
Yes?
My name is Tim Knight. I'm intrigued by the fact that our governments traditionally spend huge amounts of money on locking up pot dealers and burglars and chaps like that, and almost nothing on investigating business. Seems to me there are probably one of two reasons. One is that business people are paragons of every virtue. The other is, which I think perhaps more likely, that it's the establishment looking after the establishment.
You know, I can tell you from my personal experience that the executives I worked with, Alan Taylor, John Claghorn, Gordon Nixon, were very ethical people. They were concerned about doing the right thing in terms of honestly reporting and running the business, treating people properly. I don't think government should take the adversarial role of thinking they have to investigate business. We have laws and we have regulators who check on that regularly. If there's you know, things that are being done that aren't correct, they should be caught. You know, my problem is with the enforcement. When these things are caught that are wrong, I just don't see in Canada the penalties being given out that are being given out in the U.S. I don't think there's that as much of a deterrent.
I don't know if I'm gonna. I'm not sure that we understand exactly why there is a greater laxness in enforcement in Canada than in the U.S. I'm not sure I have a great explanation for that. I think it's a problem. It continues to persist. It's a theme that we write about again and again and again. It's probably something worth investigating further.
It's interesting, though, to say that there's greater laxness here. There are some pretty fine examples of incredible laxness in the U.S. And right now, I mean, I don't know why there isn't more outrage among the citizenry of that country about the billion-dollar settlements that are about to be made by big banking institutions with government that will just leave a bunch of homeowners, mortgage holders, ordinary taxpayers out because they've just decided this is the easiest and most efficient way to settle these scores. I don't know why that goes on. It does. I think campaign finance did a lot in this country to avoid that kind of thing here, but it may be too early to see the fruits of it.
My name is Al Emmett. I think the problem with, I'm 95% sure, the problem with reporting on the subprime crisis was that we didn't understand it. First of all, it was an American phenomenon, and second, there's the whole thing about derivatives being packaged and sold up the line and down the line. In order to learn from that, and there's a suggestion out there that we're headed into another downturn, what can we do differently next time around, other than more reading and take an economics course or something? But in order not to be blindsided again, what can we do?
You know, I don't know if there's any way you can 100% guard against the next financial crisis. I mean, one of the so-called solutions for the last one, you know, the reason they were taking all these subprime mortgages and packaging them together and securitizing it was to spread the risk around the world so it wouldn't be a problem.
And all it did was create a bigger, massive problem. And a lot of smart people were involved in putting these, you know, collateralized debt obligations and other packages together. So, you know, you have to be vigilant. Don't believe everything you read or hear. Do your own, you know, research just to some extent. And if you're really concerned, you know, have a professional invest for you. But even the professionals are going to be subject to, you know, the ups and downs of the markets. So I don't think there's any 100% way you can protect against it, but.
I think also it depends on your view of what happened. If you believe that it's a black swan, as they call it, and it was almost unpredictable, it's a bit like trying to figure out how to perfectly screen luggage that goes on airplanes, right? The theory is that the problem, no matter how sophisticated your risk protection becomes, there will always be a way to outsmart it. And the way to outsmart it will be something that nobody thought of. And I think that the more complex these financial instruments become, you can regulate them, but I don't know that there is a way to completely eliminate that risk.
If you've read the first few pages of Michael Lewis's book, you know that a lot of our understanding of this was forensic, but there were risk managers inside those banks who knew what was happening. There wasn't a lot of talking about it. I mean, even a journalist like Lewis can only write about it in retrospect. At the time, we knew there was a housing bubble. We knew that there was a lot of collateralized debt obligations being sold. We didn't know that, I didn't know what a synthetic CDO was, and that was ended up being the heart of the problem.
Well, it's still part of the cleanup. I mean, Goldman Sachs hedged its own exposure to the products that it was selling, but nobody knew that at the time, and now they're paying the price, but it's too late.
Robin Walsh, Canadian Bankers Association. And Amanda, if you're still paying ATM fees, shame on you. We'll tell you how you can avoid them. I had to get that in there. First, an observation, and it goes back to during the global financial crisis of the last few years. And one of the things we noted from our vantage point was initially as the story unfolded, a lot of the reporting that was coming into Canada or being reported, stories were being reported in Canada were about the U.S. banks and the U.S. situation and Europe to a lesser extent, and not so much about our industry. And we kind of had to push to get our story told about our banks and the different risk management activities, and certainly the regulatory system was different in this country. And that was a challenge, but it did eventually, you know, get told. And I think perhaps it was we were all learning about something that we hadn't gone through before, and it was probably a bit of both sides having to get that story out. My question would be how you square the need to make sure that stories are researched and filtered and contain both sides and as many points of view as possible, with the need to have instantaneous news, blogs, different kinds of opinions that come up and come through on the websites and into the media that way.
I mean, I think that's the. I will say, Robin, I think it's funny if you're complaining about how long it took for the Canadian banks to be well treated, because this is sort of the golden era for Canadian banks. Enjoy it while it lasts, my friend. It will pass. I'm surprised you don't all have broken arms from patting yourselves on the back. That's all. And there is an argument to make that you don't break your leg on the ski hill if you never go off the chairlift. But never mind that. I don't know. I don't know how you square. I mean, I actually find you quite helpful. When I'm doing something in terms of resources and information, instantaneous coverage of things can be difficult. It doesn't often go together that you have all of the information required and you have it immediately. So I agree that you, but I think everybody knows the bar is lower on those. Twitter isn't as good as the Wall Street Journal, and I think everybody gets that.
But it does get its way into the mainstream media and then filters out there. And then I find we're having to
distortions, you mean?
Yeah. And then
that's where Elena comes in.
My question really is aimed
at
that.
Right? I mean, that's why we still have editors at newspapers, thank God.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if last week somebody tweeted that Steve Jobs had died. And that made it around newsrooms. In fact, I think it originated with CBS News. Obviously, untruths get out there. They always have. Again, I really do think in the instant, the best thing you can do is stick with what you know. So you're not going to be offering smart analysis and interpretation 5 minutes after something happens. But you shouldn't be reporting that somebody has died if, in fact, they haven't died. There have to be some checks and balances there in terms of what gets disseminated.
David's on the record as believing that the PR profession is an undervalued one in terms of the role that it plays internally, and I guess that's where you'll come in too, in terms of offering information to people when they need it.
Yeah, when you think about how complex it is today to be a spokesperson for a company, it used to be very easy because reporters and the public didn't have the same depth of knowledge they have now. You know, if you're in charge of PR, you have to be a legal expert, human resources expert, financial expert, an operations expert, a systems expert. So. And quite often when you're providing an explanation you're part of a big company, it may involve all of those different areas. So yeah, I think PR is undervalued. Everyone needs a raise.
Welcome to all the PR professionals in the room.
Well, that certainly segues nicely into my question. I'm Suanne Kelman. I'm also at the Ryerson School of Journalism. Since Robin did a plug for his bank, may I just say that we agree that students are not sufficiently interested in business. It's a problem that we are trying to address. We are teaching business journalism now. We are talking about making an economics course mandatory for them. Well, that will be a problem in a world where they see themselves as consumers.
Are you teaching them to love business?
We try.
Okay.
And that, in fact, is what I just wanted to mention just to you, that one of the things that would really help would be a funded chair of business journalism who could be there to teach them to love business all year. But my question is, this is not true for the banks, which are very sophisticated in terms of their public relations, but what professional journalists and our students are running up against more and more in many businesses is that all questions have to go through PR. PR has one single and often very boring message, and people working for the firm are terrified of giving actual information because they will be fired. It seems to me that a lot of communication is breaking down and that many companies, again, not the banks, are in fact choosing to put out their message in other ways which they can control rather than deal with a journalist who's going to ask pesky questions and may provide a context that is not the context they want.
Well, first of all, let me say I'm delighted to hear that you're teaching business, and I agree with Amanda. They shouldn't just be taught economics, although they must have it. I think they need to be taught to understand and appreciate and love business. Understand, you know, who creates the jobs and how important it is and what it means to the GDP of the country, so that when they're covering business, they don't have necessarily an anti-business bias. They're just out to get the truth.
I've told you how to deal with that.
Yeah.
So,
but, you know, if I was still at the bank, believe me, I'd be in Gordon Nixon's office tomorrow, and I'd be saying, you know, we should look at this. This is a good idea, because Alan Taylor, who was a board member of the Canadian Journalism Foundation, was a big proponent of exactly what you're talking about. He said, if we're not going to be part of the solution in business, we can't complain about the state of financial journalism, so we have to get involved. So I agree with that. In terms of PR, you know, a common day at Royal Bank of Canada was probably more than 100 media inquiries a day from all over the world, from all sorts of people. Sometimes it's just following up on stories, sometimes it's a new inquiry. So you can't let all those calls go right to a business head or a CEO. You've got to really decide which ones that person needs to talk about. But good PR people should know enough about their organization to give media people, give reporters good information. What always bugged me about PR shops is if they had people who didn't understand the company and the industry they were working for, what were they doing talking to media? They were just order takers.
Thank you.
Sue Ann, who once famously said, "Poor sucky baby," to Kevin on the air.
Yes, I did.
So now we call her the sucky baby lady when we're thinking we want her on the show. Let's get the sucky baby lady.
Hi, my name is Karen Ho. I just recently graduated from a journalism program that was extremely fast-tracked. And so my interest in business actually comes from working at the Bank of Montreal for 3.5 years. As someone who was in a fast-tracked program, and there are many of them across the country at colleges that accelerate for postgraduate programs, or especially, I mean, Ryerson is doing an admirable thing, but they also have a very accelerated master's program as well. And I can see many students finding it hard to squeeze in an extra economics or even a basic course about how to write their own invoices when they're freelancing for various publications. With this in mind, what kind of advice would you give to students who are interested in business reporting, understanding things like balance sheets? It's intimidating to sign up for something like the Canadian Securities course when it is the cost of three.
That would be my first piece of advice.
Right, yeah. But at the cost of, say, three courses of tuition, yeah, along with extra courses and for study guides and things like that. Or many students don't, when they're looking for jobs outside of school, they would think about signing up for the student paper, and very few would look at maybe working for a bank or job shadowing a financial service manager. Would you have any advice for young students in journalism right now?
Well, I don't know about Elena. I didn't study business as my, I trained as an architect. And my interest in business and my fascination with it came because I learned about it with an open mind. So that's all I would say. You can learn about anything if you if you're interested enough in it. And so there's lots of books you can read. The Canadian Securities course is a fantastic survey course of business and macroeconomics. It's sort of an all-in-one. You're not going to, you know, be able to do anything too fancy with it, but it'll give you a basic understanding of everything from simple derivatives to macroecon. So, but if not that, then just, you know, just read. Read. There's lots of books out there. And I mean, to me, the thing that's wonderful about business is what Elena alluded to earlier, which is that it's all there. The numbers do not lie, and the numbers aren't numbers. They're people. There are stories, there are tragedies, there are missteps. You know, I said to somebody today, who at Netflix is being fired today for deciding to change the pricing structure? Because they just lost 1 million subscribers. That's a, you know, that those are people behind those stories, and that's what makes, that's what turns me on about it.
Yeah, I'd say just to jump in before Elena, you know, read the report on business. You know, watch Amanda's program on CBC.
Oh yes, watch my program on CBC.
You can, the Wall Street Journal online edition, I think, is $28 a month. I think the Financial Times of London's even cheaper. So, and the beauty of having it online is you can read it when, you know, when you have time, and you can read it wherever you are if you have internet access. So, yeah, the best thing to do is take the Canadian Securities course, study economics. But if you don't have time to do it right now, or you didn't have when you were there, certainly read the business sections and do that kind of stuff to just bring your regular knowledge up.
Any thoughts, Elena?
I don't have much to add except that, I mean, the reporters in the ROB come from a very, very broad selection of backgrounds and educations, and I think it really has to do with interest level. You learn on the job, you get better on the job, and some of our, you know, best reporters, and we have so many excellent reporters, have absolutely no business background, and many, many of us in the section never went to J school. So, you know, go figure. And David still says you should be the ROB. So there you go.
Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Olivia Globerzon. I'm with Investment Executive. I'm the insurance reporter. And as a reporter on my beat, one of the biggest things I always hear is, you know, reporters always get this wrong. And when I was debating coming to this thing tonight, one of my colleagues said to me, well, how can people expect reporters to get it as right as it is in the business world when we aren't paid to get our MBAs and we don't have the same training that, you know, a financial analyst who's studying statements all day has to work through those numbers? And as one of the few business, as one of the few people who's come to business journalism with a business degree, when I'm going through those statements and I'm thinking back to my days at business school, I will tell you that some of those numbers are really complicated. And at times I've thought about going back to school for my MBA just so I can understand those numbers. But the reality is that if people wanted an MBA to write on those numbers, you'd be looking at the reports of the analyst and not of the business journalist. So where are business journalists supposed to get that training?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. So one of the things I used to try and get the bank to do, and we would do it every couple of years, is we'd run a half-day session where we'd bring in the beat reporters covering banking, and we'd have each of the, you know, the key business heads and then the CFO kind of give a presentation to, you know, help walk people through what we felt they needed to know if they were going to cover banking. And then offer, you know, to sit down with those people for the last hour of that session. If they had questions about our financial statements and how to read them or what was important, you know, if you have 100 pages of notes in a financial statement, you need someone to say, look, you only need to look at these things, really, if you're going to come to, you know, a conclusion.
Just skip the MD&A.
Skip the little stuff.
Yeah,
the fine print on page 84 that discloses we were in trouble with the Securities Commission.
Well, most of those scant, like, you know, I read Michael Lewis's book, and you know, it is all there if you go through each and every line, but as a reporter covering probably up to three or four stories at once, you don't have the time to go through each line. And then as a result, you do become dependent on your sources. And when your sources have something to hide, my question is, where do you get that training to snuff out very quickly where there's holes?
I mean, I think that's a great question. Part of it is audience. If you're a business reporter, you're not writing for the same audience and you're not doing the same work as you are if you're an MBA, as you know. You're trying to explain most of the time, you know, although it's fun to sit here and talk about ferreting out fraud, most of the time you're explaining. And most of the time, to do that and to do it well, to do it really, really well, I think what David is describing, having some sort of training, and I've had that. I think I sat down with TD when I was a reporter, and somebody walked me through how to do that. That's sufficient to do that. But you're absolutely right. You're not going to get that level of sophistication. Most business reporters, there are some who do have it. There are analysts. In fact, I can think of two that I work with who have actual backgrounds as analysts. Most don't. And they're not writing for that audience.
Take an analyst out to lunch and see if, for the price of a lunch, he can walk you through it.
And also, as we've covered, you know, analysts are not infallible either, yep. So, you know.
Hi, my name is Robert Cosi. I'm an editor at Glacier Media. I wanted to bring the discussion into the situation that we have today. We were talking about the financial crisis a few years ago. What about today? What about the issues of Europe, Greece, Portugal, Italy? What about the job creation program of Obama? What about these things? What kind of responsibility do the reporters have today to have opinions about these things, as well as to, you know, where's that intersection between reporting that Obama's launched a job creation program and having an opinion about whether or not it will be successful and whether or not you can create a private sector job that easily?
We're not supposed to have opinions, of course. But it's interesting, in June I interviewed Jean-Claude Trichet, who's the head of the ECB, outgoing, but in June he said several times in the course of this interview, no, there's not going to be any default. Nobody's defaulting. Now what was happening at the time was there was a great discussion about whether or not there would be a technical default, that Greece wouldn't actually force its bondholders to take 50 cents on the dollar, but that they would extend the maturities, let's say. So, you know, I'm supposed to pay you tomorrow, but I'm going to pay you next year. That's a default. This was what was going on. And I said afterwards to my producer, it's really awkward when somebody in that role, who's that important and in the middle of those events, is essentially lying to you. And you can't say you're a big liar, Jean-Claude, why don't you? Because the equivalent of him saying Greece is likely to default, it's a mess, nobody agrees, Sarkozy can't stand Merkel, and my top economist is about to quit, is like somebody yelling fire in a crowded theater. The outcome is not pleasant. But it's difficult. I find it difficult because it's not a question of opinion. It's just, again, I'm the one holding the camera, the lion's eating the gazelle, and sometimes you do want to call out to the gazelle, which in this case is taxpayers the world over, by the way.
But I, you know, nobody knows. I mean, nobody, to the point about stimulus and outcome here and action, steps that were taken today by central banks around the world, none of us, nobody is in a position to know how that's going to play out. Some of this is just unprecedented. And, you know, we struggle with this every single day at story meetings. How are we going to write about this? How are we going to write about this in a new way, in a fresh way today? And how are we going to put this in a bigger perspective? One of my colleagues pointed out to me that, you know, we're trying to write history on the fly. I mean, this is what we do every day, whether it's a tweet or a blog or tomorrow's newspaper. It's still on the fly. We give it as much context as we can. It can take 40 or 50 or 60 years for economists to fight out and figure out, you know, who is right. And people are still fighting over the New Deal, you know, and whether that worked or not, what the mistakes were.
You know, I think they have limited resources, too. And all the media outlets in Canada, there's only so much time you can spend on what Obama's doing with his jobs plan, what's happening in Greece, what's happening in France. But, you know, we have a wonderful amount of good journalism online from papers around the world. And if you do want more than what you're getting in these outlets, you know, go online to the Wall Street Journal for U.S. coverage. Go online for the Financial Times of London to get more coverage of what's going on in Europe. And you'll find a lot more of it there that you guys just don't have the resources, time, or ability to cover because it's not as great a deal of interest.
And definitely bank at CIBC.
I know you don't like Royal Bank.
I'm just kidding. Yes?
Hi, it's Keith Tomaszek from the University of Western Ontario Journalism Program. my question is about, well, I'll just set it up. There was the 24-hour news cycle in terms of broadcast, and then a decade or so after that or two, we had the 24-hour news journalism cycle, which you talked about earlier. And that was, you know, 10, 12 years ago, and Amanda, you were at the forefront of that, so you got to be a part of that transformation. What do you got, two questions, what do you see, Amanda and Elena, the next trend in terms of business journalism? Because it's definitely the age in terms of broadcast of cheerleading is, I think, over. I think it's fair to say that's what it was like at the beginning. So what do you anticipate in the future? Because you had a made a little joke with Dave there about not being so easy on the banks anymore, which it's good to hear. And the second one, the second question is, are consumers demanding more from business journalism?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think the healthiest thing that's happened for business journalism is that it's out of the ghetto in a big way. And that forces business journalists who had written, you know, when I worked at Business News Network, it's a really delightfully specific audience. And they know, same with the Financial Post when I worked there with Dan Westell. They know, you know what they want, you give them what they want. There's this great, when you work in a more mainstream environment, you're reaching, you know, I often say my mother, although she happens to be fairly financially literate, but just as kind of the idea of somebody who may not care that much, but really should know about this stuff. I think that's the direction we're going. I think we will not be in the silo anymore. Everybody gets that we all need to care about this, and it'll raise the standards, which is only a good thing.
Yeah, I would only add that I think it also depends on where we are in the cycle, and I'm amazed now, having, you know, been an editor for a couple of years, how much is determined in terms of what we do, how much we do, whether it gets on A1 or whether it stays in the business section, ghettoized. It really just depends where you are in the economic cycle, you know. There's a lot more interest when things are really intense.
Do you see a change in 10 years? Where are we going to be in 10 years?
Do I see a change in 10 years in terms
of... Yeah, like if you look 10 years back in terms of broadcast journalism, it's very different than it is now. Amanda, where would you see it in 10 years? Any idea?
Well, it's hard not to think that citizen journalism is going to populate this field as well, and that'll change it. You know, HuffPost change everything. Twitter will change everything again. I don't know what it will mean. I'm confident that there will always be a need for learned arbiters like a newspaper. I love Twitter, but I wish I had an editor for Twitter. You know, or Peter Mansbridge, who would come on and say, Amanda, these are the 10 things you need to see today on Twitter, because it's just too much. And so I think we'll find a way for all of this stuff to fit together. It's exciting. It's all good.
Thanks.
Dan?
Hi, Amanda. I'm Dan Westell. I'm a 32-year business reporting veteran. I started, I didn't actually start at the ROB, but that was my first time job in 79. One of the things I've observed is the complexity of the financial universe has increased multifold. And I think it's gotten harder and harder and harder for business reporters to describe the universe accurately, let alone predict where it's going to go, because of things like derivatives and the meltdowns. And the banks, David, you probably recall this, the banks used to put out a one-page press release to announce their annual profit. It wasn't earnings then, it was profit. Now they put out 85 pages, if you printed it, or it goes on and on and on. And you have to sift through that and figure out what matters here. So I think on one side we're smothering in information, and on the other side I think the complexity of that information is increased multifold. And so my question is, A, am I right, and B, is there a way through this that where we could, can the media help people navigate this universe? You look at Europe, I look at the coverage of Europe and I've stopped reading. Why? Because I can't make sense of it. I know bad things are happening, they're happening really fast. I don't understand all the linkages, and I don't know if you do or you do. You know, why if a guy sneezes in Ireland, a bank goes bust in Greece? I mean, because that's the kind of change we're talking about now. And can you make sense of this? Am I right, and is this fixable? Or understandable, perhaps.
Well, can Jean-Claude Trichet make sense of it? I mean, it's, you know.
It is, there's no question it's more complex. I mean, I think one of the things that's, when we talk about the last crisis, the wonderful complexity of financial products, which has enabled so much capital movement, it's a beautiful thing, but it has an ugly underbelly. And I mean, I think that the most simplest answer to what's happening in Europe is it's exactly what happened with Lehman Brothers. There are a bunch of derivative obligations out there, and we're not sure where they are, and everybody's terrified about what happens if they all come due. But that's overly simplified, but I work in TV, so.
But Dan, you're right. I think Dan is right. It's a lot more complicated out there. I mean, the banks have, you know, they call them different things, but basically it's a new business committee because some of the products that are being developed are so complex that there's no one in the organization on his or her own that really understands the total implication of it. So they have senior people on a committee who will look at it and often take 6 months before they even decide to go ahead with the product because it's so complex and complicated. Never mind how everything fits together in the whole universe. So that's why good journalism is so important, because journalists are translators. They take complex things and they make it make sense to, you know, everyone else out there. It's a tougher job than it used to be.
Or at least we attempt to do that. Mike Eppel from 680 News. Following up on that comment, it is absolutely much more difficult now to bring it into a context where the average listener or viewer can understand. I think that is something that has been amplified greatly over the past few years, leading up to the Lehman Brothers collapse and such. But to another point that was mentioned earlier about the, no one wants to necessarily yell fire, but even when you do, and whether it's in the printed word or on television or through radio, that there is a problem, a lot of people choose not to listen, or A, or B, they don't understand that there actually is a problem because they have been told, well, we have to stay in the market, never, you know, try to time it and all that. There is that trade-off between what is actually happening and what they've been basically taught to do through marketing, if you want to put it in those terms. So you have to, in my context, in a fairly short amount of time, and it depends if you have time to go into greater depth in the press or what have you, in the papers, or in my case, fairly short reports on 680 and other stations. You know, that is a major challenge. And my other only point that I want to make is, when it comes to talking about what is going on, you have sell side and buy side people who are coming on to discuss what's going on. Leading up to bubbles and such, you only have buy side who say it's all great, and you never have the sell side because they don't want to be seen as yelling fire. And then when it is a sell-off, then no one wants to come back in and buy. So there's a lot of challenges on from our end as reporters dealing with what's going on today.
I agree.
I don't think you'll get any disagreement up here. Somebody said the other day that a bubble is an investment you didn't make.
Well, on that note of agreement, I think our time is up. Anna, David, and Amanda, I want to thank you very much. It's been stimulating, enlightening. The thing I always liked about business compared to politics, which I covered for too many years in Ottawa, was the stories had a beginning, a middle, and an end, business stories, and they had winners and losers. And I think we can agree that we are all winners tonight, or you folks haven't been here. And you have been a great audience, and I thank you for coming, and I thank you for volunteering your time. So please join us for some refreshments upstairs around the corner.
And if you want to join in the cause, Natalie Turvey, our executive director, is there in the second row. And please speak to her about any way you think you can help us. Thank you very much.